I'm getting a lot of positive feedback from everybody about the experiences they have been having in the last week, about programs they've been to, group experiences they've had, how it's been very exciting for them. And I find that to be very significant because although I haven't had exactly the same kind of group experience, basically I've been around here and taking care of the house and the garden and everything. And of course I've been editing lectures nonstop all week long. So now you can find on our lectures download on Harry Media all three lectures from Moscow. We've put them as a little group so that you can understand what they are and download them accordingly, because it's, I think, important that all three of them are heard in a kind of a series, because a series is really what it is. It's a series of discussions which bring you gradually, well, not really even gradually, we get right to the point, which just display my understanding of what is spirituality, my understanding of what is the essence of the self, what is the supreme, how we get there, how we realize anything in this world. And I had a very fun time giving those three lectures in Moscow, I suppose mainly because it's a different atmosphere than in St. Petersburg. In St. Petersburg, we have the deities. It's a very magnificent physical structure. It's a very magnificent arrangement on the altar. The deities are very large and magnificent and wonderful. And it's a very awe-inspiring, spiritual, deeply spiritual experience. So when I'm in St. Petersburg, I tend to be more serious. I tend to be more careful. I don't make so many jokes. But in Moscow, it's a much more interesting experience in the sense that we're in a hall. It's a kind of a club atmosphere. We play music there also. In a club atmosphere, it's a lot more informal. And people are a lot closer to me. It's easier to see them all. And I feel more comfortable in the sense of the way I speak and the jokes I can make. And it's more like a family experience. So I think these three lectures or any of the lectures in Moscow more represent the casual me rather than the formal me, which you see in those lectures in St. Petersburg or even here in this broadcast. As I was editing all these lectures, well, I wasn't really editing them. I was processing them because they were done on a very small MP3 player. But I was re-experiencing a lot of the feelings of the atmosphere, a lot of the feelings of what was done. And I realized that it's so much more fun for me to be standing in front of real people. Now, I don't mean to insult you by saying you're not real people, but in its actual physical presence, you are virtual people to me. You are virtual people because you are in those, right now I'm seeing four different places. You are little boxes at 320 by 240 resolution lined up on my screen. And you are a two-dimensional image of people who are somewhere. Now, in my mind, I know that you are people who I am talking to. I can see how you respond to me. There are another 40 places connected all around the world I know it's usually between 200 to 400 people or maybe even more around the world connected on any Saturday. And yet it's not the same. It's a much deeper experience for me as a speaker to actually be sitting or standing in front of real physical people as opposed to virtual people. And I think that's also part of the positive feedback I've gotten from others who have had group experiences this week, which have been very exciting for them, because they were with a groups of real people doing real things and having a lot of real fun in that sense. And I also realized while I was editing these live lectures that I become quite different when I speak in front of real people, because I'm focused on one particular group and their energy feeds back to me instantly. Now, your energy also feeds back to me virtually, but it's a very diverse group from all around the world. And the way that energy feeds back is quite diverse. So it's different than when you're in front of a group of people who are all in the same place and sharing each other's energies. It brings out a very unique kind of a feedback that makes me very aware of this direct, localized connection between me and those who are right in front of me, who, if I say something funny, I can experience their smile or their laughter. I can hear it. It's a very unique thing. And if I say something that's not very good, I get like question marks in their heads. I can instantly adapt to make what I say clearer. And another important point is I have a direct connection to my translator. When I was in Kamala Mullah's flat and I was giving that broadcast, I was personally very disturbed because poor Sudhadani had to sit in a hallway behind a closed door. And I so much wanted him to physically be sitting next to me, like Mahashaya does when he translates line by line, because I realize how we are such an integral team. We are one unit. He becomes my voice to those who are listening in the Russian language. So the more I think about this, the more a theme is arising. And this theme is connected to this idea which has become very prominent nowadays amongst those who examine the energies of the world, those who are analyzing what is going on in existence. And that theme is related to the change that's happening in the universe, or the change that is happening that is very significantly affecting the Earth. Now, because I'm married to an astrologer, we get all these astrological journals. And although I'm not very educated in the science and I'm not even very interested in it, it's just not something I do. I just leave it to her. But some of these articles in these journals are very interesting. I kind of gloss over where they get real technical about the this and the that. And I'm reading their analysis of things. There's one magazine we get. It's called The Mountain Astrologer. The people who write in it are very smart. Mountain Astrologer. The people who write in it are very smart. They're very educated. They have an incredible capacity to deeply look into the world and that which is around them and relate it directly to that which they see in their professional life, the astrological, or in reality, astronomical influences, the influences of the bodies in the heavenly spheres. And one article especially struck me very deeply. Now, of course, all the articles were talking about what's happening and what's coming. Because as far as astrologers are concerned, this coming period, starting basically now, of course it's been going on for a long time, but and very significantly increasing in 2008, 2009, and really peaking in 2012 to 2014. Now, I'm just talking what they say about astrology, but very, very significant transformations are taking place. And the effect of this, the sum total of the transformations, which will manifest in a very, very positive way, will not really click until 2040. And now I'm seeing all of these people say that. They're very much emphasizing this transformative process. They're very much emphasizing the fact that nobody likes to change, but everyone will be forced to change by circumstances. And then I examine that in relationship to even what scientists say, what economists say, what politicians are fearing, what businessmen are speaking about, what people in general are doing and feeling. And I see in almost all aspects of society a confirmation of that which is being discussed in astrological journals. Now, before I speak about this one particular aspect, I'd like to just review a little bit about what's going on in the world today. Let's start with the spiritual transformation. We find spiritually an enormous transformation started taking place in the mid-60s, where alternative forms of spirituality were understood to be very valuable. The Eastern traditions met the Western traditions, where people started becoming aware on all kinds of levels about things which just were rather hidden before, maybe in groups like the Theosophists or maybe in very small groups of people who got together and discussed things in ways which were considered to be very strange or very unusual. But now it's mainstream, practically. That which is alternative is such a huge thing. I mean, you'll find just common references to karma on TV everywhere. Karma or reincarnation is just old stuff. Nobody even cares about it anymore. You've got TV shows coming out in this coming season all about the supernatural, all about things which deal with life and death and after death and the connection between the two. You find discussions about the transformation of the material into the spiritual. This is just commonplace TV about the paranormal, about the psychic. The biggest shows have reference to these things. Major networks are transforming their whole broadcasting. That means if major prime time TV is transforming in this way, that the majority of people are ready for it because they never give you something that you're not going to buy. That means we have gone a long way. Of course, it's not like, you know, religious spiritual. It's not like people will come and start expanding their devotion to God because of these TV shows. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying there's an enormous transformation in the consciousness and awareness of people. This is manifested in the way people see things, the way it's filtered into businesses. There's also simultaneously impetus for business to change. Let's move to science. Religion and science has often had difficulties. But now we see science is saying things like the way quantum physics is questioning reality and, in fact, questioning the very basis of things and actually becoming quite Eastern about its description. But we see in the scientific discussions about the global climate changes and the reasons for it. At the same time, we see the diminishing supply of oil, or rather the proportionate or apparent diminishing of supply as compared to the demand because of the markets in India, in Eastern Europe, Russia, and China for more and more cars, more and more refined gasoline. The demand is increasing faster than the supply can keep pace, and therefore the supply has to increase. Now, of course, there's a lot of what's called price gouging, which means they just raise the price just to make more money. Energy companies are making piles of money. Yet there is a physical connection which geologists are charting out very clearly between the increase of demand and the capacity to supply that demand, not only in pulling it out of the earth, but in making and refining the stuff to supply it. So therefore, there's a lot of green kind of alternative energy things going on. Electric cars, biofuel cars, hydrogen vehicles, and this technology spilling over to personal electric generation. So there's an enormous green revolution taking place. So in America anyway, there's incredible amounts of money being poured into alternative energy. It all of a sudden has become the darling of venture capitalists. That means the favorite of venture capitalists, to put all the money they into this alternative scene, to transform the way energy is created and used or consumed to help stop the global warming, change it. At the same time, economists are seeing a certain cycle. They're seeing a certain cycle wind down because they see this energy problem as being very significant because the alternative things started too late to meet the difficulty of the combustible fuels and reducing the dependency on burning fuels came too late in relationship to the global climate changes, to the changes in the global ecological systems. And we see that although there's an enormous transformation taking place, an enormous awareness, it's not in a one-to-one relationship with need. It's late. It's delayed because people don't want to change. People hate change. If things were one way, they want it to always be that way. People love the status quo. We have talked about this. People love when things remain exactly the way they are and everything's comfortable and secure, because change is very challenging. Change challenges us to make transformations, and we don't like the idea of change like this. It's too disturbing. It's too frightening, the idea of risking our stability and comfort to make a change. Just see how slowly it has come, this spiritual awareness. It's just something that's just trickled into society. It's not like you can have an argument with somebody and change them. It's not like you can preach. And this is one of the faults of preaching religious themes. You don't really change things by some edict or by just defeating somebody or just convincing somebody. It's something that filters into life. It's something that's absorbed into the consciousness. It's something that's absorbed into the awareness and which grows organically from within when the times are ripe. Similarly, nobody wanted to change with this ecological understanding, but they're being forced to. And they see it now. They see huge parts of the North Pole melting. They see the incredible droughts and fires that are coming. They see very serious transformations of the weather. In England, the heat of the spring has created such an abnormal manner in which the springtime creatures manifested. We have seen very serious disturbances in the normal flow of life, and people therefore realize we have to do something about it. Businesses realize it. Car manufacturers did not want to change. They saw no reason to change. Until the price of gasoline is going very, very high. You see, in Europe, gas was always very high. Therefore, itsy-bitsy little cars with very good fuel economy were the rule, not the exception. In America, gas was very cheap. So therefore, huge cars with 8 million horsepower, which of course makes no sense since the speed limits are very low here as compared to the German Autobahn. And now everybody's talking about fuel economy. And even car manufacturers are talking about very rapidly bringing out hydrogen cars, bringing out electric cars. We have this transformation going on in business because business sees it's good for business to be ahead of the transformation, to put yourself in the proper place to make money. Now, if you consider these different factors that are going on, and actually they're going on in all aspects of life, you come to that which I feel is the whole point of what I have been doing last week, which is also totally about groups of people. But unlike others, when I deal with groups of people, it starts with me being alone and just thinking and just figuring and feeling and understanding and trying to get to the essential ingredients about what makes groups work. And now I get to that one article in Mountain Astrologer, which I found to be really significant, at least to me. This man had made an analysis of historical trends of the way society was basically organized over long periods of time according to the astrological influences of certain outer planets. And he made a very good case for exactly when things were transforming, how things were transforming. I'll skip his analysis because the past is not very important to this discussion. But what is important is that he says that now, in this upcoming period, around 2010, the transformation will be towards community living, ecologically based ecosystems in a social environment. And I thought this is just really the whole theme of this transformation. At present, we have a very impersonal social existence. If somebody wishes to be involved in a personal way with others, especially groups of people, they have to leave their impersonal existence, let's say living in amazingly large apartment buildings where they don't know anybody else in the building, or in where I live, suburbia, where neighbors are people you just wave to and talk to about the weather. Or out in rural communities where you're just one house surrounded by land and you never see anybody anymore unless you go to the village. This very impersonal kind of situation we're in is something which we must leave to go into a personal situation. Like right now, if we wish to associate in a personal way with a group of people, we have to leave our impersonal situation and go to a club or go to a lecture or go to a church or a temple. Or we have to go to a shopping mall or go to a restaurant. We have to leave our situation and go to a place where people as a group associate. That is basically the way we come in contact with a community of people. It's a community based, let's say, on religion. That's still a big community. Or on spiritual inclination, alternative things, yoga class, or a conference, or a workshop, or school. School is a very good social environment. Or a party. In other words, we have to get up and go somewhere to be with people who have a similar interest at that moment. Now, that means we leave that place at the end and go back to our impersonal existence. The foundation of our lives is this rather impersonal existence where the only people we have to relate to are our own families. Now, let's just consider for a second what actually is the foundation of our life. And then let's understand from that point about group interaction and what would be the way to create or to enter into a system of community which would have all of the elements required to make it work. Now, of course, somebody may say, well, why should we do that? It works now. And I think that the reason why we should do that is because it's probably not going to work for long periods of time. Because as the prices of energy become very high, the price of living is going to go way, way up. You see it already happening. The price of living, the cost of living is going way, way up. And as economic difficulty arises, which it will, your capacity to pay for life will decrease. And when your capacity to pay decreases, your anxiety level and stress level will increase. It will become very difficult to make ends meet, and everyone will become very fearful and full of paranoia. What do I do? But no one wants to change. It's like you're in a vice where you're being forced to transform just to survive. That means you're being pressed to transform so that you can survive. And this being pressed into transformation is exactly what's happening now. All the elements are assembling to press this transformation. Now, usually people talk about transformation as a transformation of consciousness. And that is true to a large extent, because after all, any positive change that we make has to be a product of the transformation of our consciousness. We have to positively transform. Yet even those who are religionists, spiritualists, or so on, don't like change. They don't like change. They also want everything to be always the same. Therefore, whatever scripture they have should never change. Whatever ideas were there traditionally should never change. Even the way it looks, the way you dress, the way you act, should not change. Because change is bad. This reflects everybody's understanding that change is something we don't want. But we're being forced to change by global climate change, by dangerous economic situations where many predict there will be recession after this global increase bursts. There'll be forcible change in our living habits as we adapt to this difficulty with economy and what we have to buy and pay. So we're being forced to change. So even as spiritualists, we're being forced to change, to adapt. And now I get to the point that I've been trying to get to. What is it that we have to transform? Well, let's talk about us as people who are involved in our broadcasts, who are involved in listening to these lectures in the downloaded format, who are involved in discussions with others about spiritual things. What specifically is it that we have to deal with? Well, let's get very practical. We're going to be, and we are already, affected by the exact same things that everybody else is affected by. I look out here at this very dysfunctional community in Alachua, and I see exactly the same problems and exactly the same reasons for those problems as anyone else is experiencing in society, except they're not even willing to make the consciousness transformation to deal with them, that community out there in Alachua. And I see that the whole key is community. Out there, they've got community, but they have no community at all. And I'd like to examine that. Long ago, maybe in the beginning of the 70s, Prabhupada was talking about farms, farm communities. And sometime after that, people thought to get a farm to community together means you go out and you buy a lot of land. And you especially need that land because you're going to have a lot of cows, because you got to drink a lot of milk. And you can't kill cows, so you're going to have thousands and thousands of cows ultimately to continue having milk. Now, I was amazed at the complexity of developing community. After all, I am a graduate with a degree in social sciences. For me, social scientific, shall we say, creation of community, maintenance of community, transformation of community is a very significant aspect. I saw dealing with it in Mayapur as to be incredibly complex. Especially in Mayapur, we had Bengalis and we had foreigners. They were foreigners, these white people from all around the world, different countries, different cultures, different mentalities, all of them totally different. But to the Indians, the locals, they were bundled under one grouping called the whiteys, the foreigners, the saibs. And looking at that was for me a great fascination, because you've got a completely reverse kind of situation as would be in any other country. And yet it's perfectly normal. And here are all these people lumped together who had really no connection between each other at all. And to make a community out of that was fabulously difficult. So I tried to get into what really makes community. Now I know the idea had been you buy land, you put up buildings, people live there, you grow some food, you have some cows, voila, community. It's a farm project. But it's not really so. I see that here in Alachua, the ISKCON community here. There's nothing that is community about the place. Yet there's an enormous amount of land out there. There's almost 1,000 people out there. There's a big temple. There's great deities. They get together sometimes on Sundays or maybe on a festival day. They have a school. They have cows. They have no community. Sometimes people get together in a friendly way, but there's no community. I have contact with those who are intimately involved with every aspect of the place, and there is no community. Sometimes people ask me in other countries, how can we create community? Should we go buy land? Should we duplicate the same model of community development where you go buy land, you put up some buildings, you invite some people in, you... And I say, wait a minute. Wait a minute. What is that community? Let's go back to what's going on in the world. The reason why everything is transforming is economic, ultimately. It's the environment. It's the way in which our very basic life functioning is affected. Let's just stick to economy and environment. You could even just stick to economy and accomplish everything. Why are you living where you're living now? Let's discuss that one point. Because if you want to make a community, it doesn't matter whether it's based on religious things or spiritual things. Because what does that mean? You believe in the same thing? There's communities, let's say, in other parts of the world where everybody believes in the same thing. In Islamic countries, you're forced to believe in the same thing. Christian countries, the social structure means you should believe the same thing. In Jewish countries, they believe the same thing. Everybody believes same God, same religion. That doesn't make community. The high Christians believe in the same thing. They have no community. In Mayapur, the Bengalis and the foreigners believe in exactly the same thing. Very strictly, very powerfully. They will be one voice when it comes to preaching this one thing. But there's no community. So belief system is not a significant factor in community. I lived in a great community in Oxia. I've told you about it, this ecological village I lived in. Everybody believed different things, but we had a really knockout community there. We worked together. We had parties together. We were in and out of each other's houses all the time. Our animals would walk in and out of our houses and everybody's houses. Every animal was welcome. You know, cats, dogs, welcome everywhere. You would sit out front and eat while people were walking by. You would share with people like that. It was actually a community, yet nobody had anything in common. So that belief system does not seem to be part of community. Yet, you might say the belief system, now excuse me for sterilizing the term, because using the word faith or religion or, you know, being spiritual or whatever, it's a belief system. If you see it as something so significant like that, it's a belief system. It means you believe it to be the most significant thing there is because you separate it from your life. Your whole life can be a mess, but if you have this belief system, you think everything is great and fine and wonderful and perfect. You are superior, you are chosen, and so on. Now, that belief system does not affect really what goes on in community. And hey, that is a really essential point. Because community is more than a belief system, much more. In fact, if you were to bring down the basic things in a community, you will find ultimately a community is where people relate, where people interact, but much more, where people support each other, where people share, where you see the interests of others in the community as being your interests. If somebody's sick, we help them. If somebody's freaked out, we console them. If somebody's economically screwed, we help them. That's community. It's a community where we share, where we interact. Now, obviously, even in Alachua, they think like that, but what makes community is that you actually do it on the fundamental basis that counts for you. What is it? Let's go back to my original question. Why do you live where you live? Well, the answer is obvious. It's what I can afford. Everybody lives where they live for the number one reason, it's what they can pay for. Don't you have in your mind, well, if I was a millionaire, I'd get myself that kind of place. Don't some people have in their mind, if you don't have that nice place, when I get more money, I shall move to there. Where I live now is very much a function of what I can afford. And it's related to where I make my money. I make my money here doing this, and therefore I could afford this place to live. Everything else is secondary. Buying food, buying clothes, cars, television, healthcare. It's all subordinate to this. There are other factors sometimes, like, you know, you have to live in a certain place, not only because of your job, but because of taking care of relatives. That's less significant, but sometimes it's important. Now, let's go back to that point. We have an interest to live where we live because it is related to the core of everything that affects us, at the core of our very existence, how I'm going to pay, how I'm going to support everything. Now, let's go back to creating community. How significant have these quote-unquote farm communities been? Well, they've not been very significant. Why? Because if, let's take me. If I move to a farm community, I'm going to be living in the middle of a lot of land. Now, I don't mind that. I love land. I love plants. I love trees. I love nature. But, for example, if I was to even move out into the country, even just down Newberry Road here, I would get out of internet range very rapidly. I wouldn't have an internet connection. Some places just don't have it. I would be forced to do everything through telephone lines. Maybe I might have some DSL connection, maybe not. I certainly wouldn't be able to have two connections like I have now. I've got a cable, and I've got a DSL connection in this house. All you people who listen on the radio, the audio connection, that's my DSL connection. And all of you who watch this video, that's my cable connection. I've got all kinds of facilities here that I wouldn't have out there. And these things are related to our economy. Like, for example, my wife sees clients. They physically come here. We have all kinds of reasons why we are here. These reasons are economic. Now, I might love to move to some rural environment, but if I have no way to make money, I'm not going to go out and sell cookies on the street. I'm not going to sell incense. And selling books nowadays, you could barely make enough money to pay for your next meal. And besides that, I'm old. Being a salesman doesn't appeal to me. How am I going to live? That's my question. In other words, you could have the greatest community set up. Most beautiful land on earth. Fabulous stream running through it. But why should I live there? What's in it for me? Or to be more extremely black and white about it, how am I going to make money there? How am I going to pay for me, for my family? Now, most people who make community don't think about that because they're not trained in social sciences. At the bottom is economics. Everything else flows from there. Let's say you want to make a community. You must first address economics. You know what's interesting about this Alachua place? The people who started it were very smart people. They made a business. It was called Day Lilies. They made flowers. Lilies are flowers. They grew these flowers and then sold them. It was a very profitable business. It was so profitable, they bought a lot of land. And they brought a lot of people there and gave them jobs. And people who were fried out in other places, who had no money, who wanted an independent life, who wanted to take care of their families in a proper way, said, fantastic. I can come to the country. It's cheap to live here. I got a job and I can take care of my family. So they came, a lot of them came. But then the more people came, the more they wanted to make a Hare Krishna community out of it. And then all this complexity started. And politics started. A lot of politics and intrigues around, you know, religious themes and management themes. And how some people didn't really want to work so hard and wanted to be supported by the group. You know the whole thing. And the business was sold. The people involved discouraged and moved to the Gainesville, where we're living here. And the economic basis disappeared. And the community went along trying to fumble its way through. And now it is a situation where everybody's doing their own thing. They try to keep it together. They try to have some kind of community. It's really nothing. I'm sorry to be so descriptive of it, but it's important to see that. Because communities must be founded on, be maintained on, and be ever continued with the economic basis. So when people talk to me about community, and they start talking about buying, I say, hold everything. What's important is the economic basis of that community. What is the glue that will cause me to move somewhere? So first of all, I have to have a reason, and that reason has to be economic. Now, economic reasons can be multiple. For example, you could have a project where there's some kind of a business at its basis, where something is produced. But something nowadays should not be just a consumer item, which is a non-essential good. It should be something which is essential. That's very important. Because if it's not an essential good, it will have difficulty when everybody has difficulty very soon. Food is an essential thing. Medicine is an essential thing. Health products. Energy is a very essential thing. Let's get to energy. Even you have a community. If you expect people to live in caveman style, no electricity, no amenities, you're not only asking people to risk their economic future, but you're asking them to transform their standard of living backwards. And you can tell people all you want that simple living is high thinking. But I look around at all these simple living communities and I see only very simple people living there. I don't see intellectuals. I don't see very dynamic people who are making significant transformative changes in existence. I don't see professionals who are doing some service to people in society. Okay, I don't mean to sound lousy like that, unless they live nearby to a city. And listen, here's an important point. Why was Oxia, where we lived in Sweden, so successful as a community like that? In other words, why did it work with people living there and people feeling comfortable there? It's because it was a 10-minute drive to Malmo. It's a 10-minute drive to the city. Everything you wanted was 10 minutes away from that city. If you're going to have a community, it has to have access to a center of population where people can buy things, sell things, get services. In other words, it has to be near to a population center. The closer it is to some population center, the more successful it has a chance of being. And on top of that, there have to be economic reasons for people to be there, an economic base. So there have to be businesses which are relevant to that population center. For example, food or whatever. But the energy has to be there too. How are you going to power it? Therefore, free energy development, something which I started getting into practically in 1980. People all around the world laughing about it. It's not possible, they said. You're just simply some kind of fool, they said. But I said, of course it's possible. It's just that we haven't figured it out yet. So let's figure it out. Because the whole key to the transformation is to break dependency on energy from outside. To have your energy source inside. So that, for those of you who live in cold climates, you can heat yourself. Okay, somebody says use wood or whatever. Okay, listen, there's not that much wood out there, and it's getting worse. And anyway, if you're going to have to live somewhere where there's wood, you're going to have to get the wood from where it is to where you are. Nowadays, that means tractors. That means diesel. That means factories. Okay, they say, get bulls. Hey, you don't have a clue. You don't have a clue of what it means to be behind six bulls in a train who are pulling wood out of a forest. First of all, you don't have a clue what it means to take care of a forest. Second of all, you don't have a clue what it means to cut down big trees. And third of all, you don't have a clue what it means to pull big trees out of a forest with oxen. I saw it all in Almvik. I was watching it, and I was saying, whoa, this is really insanely difficult. And I knew only a handful of people who could possibly even think of doing such a task. It is so complicated, especially when it's so incredibly cold outside. And then you need to cut big trees. You know what it means to cut big trees? I have a chainsaw. And when I have to cut through oak, all my trees are oak, this big, it is an incredible experience. cutting through oak with a chainsaw. Now, where are you going to get chainsaws in that primitive environment? So you have to have two man saws. And just think about cutting up enough wood for a whole community. You're going to have everybody employed. Sure. It's a great employment just to cut wood so you stay warm. You can engage 30, 40 people doing that. But what kind of people are you going to engage? Not one person watching this broadcast. Not one person is going to do that. So what do you mean by community? Simple living, high thinking? I don't think so. I think what we mean by community is a place where we feel comfortable living together. And that is the essence of survival in the future. Put aside all of these simplistic traditional ideas. However, there are principles within those ideas which are very important. The number one principle being, how do you live? You need to heat, you need to cook, you need to feed yourselves, you need to have cloth. Yet, if you make communities based on those needs, communities where you generate your own energy somehow or another, communities where you make cloth, sell it, communities where you make food, sell it, or communities where you bring in food, process it, sell it, or communities based on programming, or communities based on education, offering educational services, or communities based on offering retreats for people to come into a very spiritual environment where you might have educational programs and meditational programs and speakers coming, musical programs. You can bring all kinds of, like, the people who sing on my music broadcasts here. Or you can have healing types of engagements. Now, if you think about that, that's an economic basis. People will pay for that. And the people who work there will be that kind of community. Yet I have been to just that kind of a place. And going behind the scenes, in West Palm Beach, I went to exactly such kind of a place. West Palm Beach is a place in Florida. And there were many politics amongst people. And some of the people who worked there only got like $10 an hour. Some only got like $8 an hour. As soon as they got a better job, they left. So this kind of a community based with such a kind of a project will also have significant difficulties of dealing with the economic needs of the people within the community. And none of them lived there. They lived outside and came in to the project. Fair enough. As long as you're not attached to everybody working in your project, as long as you have no demand of the project owning anything as a whole, where private enterprise works within your local area, private enterprise, capitalism, you probably have a good opportunity or good possibility of making that community work economically. And you may have people who disagree with you living in the community, because somebody may agree with you now and disagree with you later. Therefore, going out and buying land, not exactly the first step. Maybe it's like the sixth step or something like that. Two, develop community requires an understanding of what a community is and how a community can grow. And I would suggest that a very good way to do that would be to study what a community could do. In other words, what would be that basis upon which it grows? What would be that economic basis? It could even be some rich guy says, I'd like to make a housing project, and I'd like to also have, like, say, some clinic kind of environment, or educational center environment, or something like that. Or maybe even a factory of some kind. There's got to be something there which is the glue of that community economically, where it will say, we're hiring. Please come. Accept gainful employment. take care of yourself and your family and live here, which is close to a significant population center, so you do not feel cut off, and where there are full modern amenities, so you do not feel alienated, and where there are friends who can support you, friends who can share with you, friends who share that which you love. And those friends will get together and make a temple, for instance. Those friends will get together and make programs, for instance. But as soon as the idea that the community and the belief system are intimately connected, your community starts to fall apart, even if it has an economic basis. Because community has to be free. Otherwise, it doesn't exist. It doesn't last. And it has to allow widely divergent understandings of life. And then you get into this whole thing of like zoning and codes and laws. It's a complex thing. Zoning and codes and laws. What you can do, where you can do it, how you can do it. So that people won't interfere with others. Yeah, in any community, any village has laws. Everywhere there are codes. This is the third time I've talked about this topic. Each time I've gone through these steps, and each time I've convinced myself the only way to make community is to do it this way. And then I've convinced myself that ultimately it'll just become part of this world. Think about that. So if you're making a community with the goal of making utopia within a crazy world, it will not work. Because sooner or later, that crazy world and your utopia will merge along those common features of political disruption, social disturbance, economic factors, and everything else that everybody else suffers from. Does that mean you should not do it? Absolutely not. But you should do it with an understanding of what's really going on. Because ultimately, this is what's going to happen anywhere, anyway, everywhere. These little community kind of centers will be the future, but the awareness of everybody will also have taken significant steps to allow the continuity of these kind of communities. Therefore, the problem has been to try to create utopia in the middle of illusion. But now if you try to create a viable community within an evolving world, when the need for that community is very strong, for when living in cities becomes too expensive, except for the rich, you'll already be there. And you'll be there with friends. When everybody else is struggling and feeling very alienated and alone, you'll have a kind of a community to live within. That is the new element I wanted to add that I've understood. Because previously I left it open-ended that you're just going to end up in the same thing and you know you have to be very... But I never really felt there was a motivation to get into it. Previously I was a little bit negative about communities. And even though I said, you've got to have them, I never really felt very confident about them because of this utopia being swallowed by the outside world. But now, as I see the outside world is being forced to change, because the outside world doesn't change unless it's forced, but because we are being forced to change, the outside world will evolve because it has no choice. And the cities will become expensive places, too expensive, because of energetic concerns. And therefore, people are either going to have big time trouble or they're going to take the alternative route of having small communities, complete systems of community. And I think that's very, very encouraging to me. Because of this forcible change, at the time when these communities start existing, they will exist within an environment which will nurture their growth rather than crush their growth out of existence. And I think it's important that this sectarian spiritual consciousness is not there to destroy the glue of the community later on. So I am now officially changing my stance from being a skeptic about the steps of creating community to being an optimist. I think it's possible now, considering the forcible changes that are becoming very obviously part of the future here in this world. And I think it's now time to start really talking about how to situate ourselves so that such a community can work. And again, it all bases on that economic basis. It bases on engagements. It bases on having all of the factors in place so that it will work. And I thought this was a very good opportunity to discuss it because this is what I've been talking about or thinking about, actually also talking about in some sense all week long. And I'm sorry if this has not been a very spiritual kind of lecture. I know there are some of you out there who just want me to talk about Radha and Krishna and nice spiritual things so that life will become easier for you. But I'm concerned about how people are going to live. And I've seen that, for example, people who are sick and dying because of not taking care of themselves, or people who are economically getting into more and more stress, or people whose situation is becoming intolerable, are either going to just surrender themselves totally to God and lose all connection to this world, or they're going to not do that and get really screwed up. For those who are going to just lose all connection to this world, I have nothing to say anyway. Because for those who are going to have no connection with this world, I have nothing to say to them. Because there are already existing groups of people who also have no connection to this world. And one can find very sympathetic spirits there. I don't know how successful that will be for one after death, but it exists already. I am a person of this world, and I like to make things work on a fundamental level, at least in a way where people can have a great peace within themselves. And that means just simply to make a few adjustments, because we've seen that not making those adjustments tears people away from their capacity to feel spiritual community. Anyway, that's why I speak about this, because I think it's becoming more and more relevant. And that relevance will only become more urgent as time goes by. So forgive me if I've been too practical, but I think part of community goes after these fundamental issues into the way we interact. The creation of community goes beyond these fundamental issues of economic stability and so on into the way we interact as people. Because if you look at the way people interact in religious communities or even any kind of a community that has spirituality involved, there's a lot of politics involved. There's a lot of envy involved. There's a lot of people trying to stop you from doing what you're trying to do. People who are trying to change what you do. People being obstacles in your life. And therefore, social interaction is an essential element for everybody. Therefore, in Vedic terms, protection of children, of old people, stability in families, governmental stability, protection of the people, economic factors in how to support, and the smooth flow of all functioning and activity in society. These are intimately connected to our consciousness. I've seen people who declared themselves so spiritual, and all day long they've got in their mind some kind of argument with somebody else, or some kind of like envy or hatred or disturbance socially, and they're forgetting everything about spirituality, and they're just absorbing themselves in fight, in quarrel. Hey, sounds like Kali to me. Therefore, instead of saying, no, none of that exists, all that really counts is just surrendering yourself to God, I'm saying, let's deal with it. Let's deal with it and try to balance both our lives and the essence of what we are within one cohesive being, us. I was speaking a lot about this 97, 98, and I saw it as clearly then as I see it now, but I know how to express it much better now. I know the problems much better now. And yet the solutions are quite different in my mind, in the sense of, as soon as you try to restrict community, you create the seeds of its destruction. Anyway, I hope that I have moved another step forward in this discussion, and I'm sorry if there's repetition here that has bored anybody. We have one question, which is okay by me. And it's a very good question. The question goes that any community of people should be very harmonious. In other words, people should feel some kind of harmony between each other. But in reality, there are very few people who are capable even of feeling such harmony. Now, I agree 100% with the statement. But I disagree that community is dependent on such harmony. Of course, it depends on what you think a community should be, or what your expectation of it is. For example, if you move to a Hare Krishna community, obviously you would think it should have some harmony, because that's the idealism speaking. And believe me, I have nothing against idealism. I think idealism is fabulous. I think idealism is that which makes life worth living. That as soon as you lose your idealism, basically you lose contact with anything that could possibly be good in this world. But, I mean, of course, you know, there may be, of course, people who aren't idealistic, people who just like to enjoy in different ways, but I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I should have said, and I'm sure that many of us feel the same, idealism is the basis upon which we grow, the basis upon which we feel connected to the future, that there should be some idealistic basis upon which we act and which we grow. Now, a community, if it's based on idealism, is not going to succeed. But a community where the people in it are idealists has a much better or even a good chance of succeeding. Now that may sound contradictory, but let me explain it a little deeper. If the whole basis of the community seems to be an ideal, that there has to be some ideal there, that when the ideal is there, the community has some existence. The purpose of the community is to fulfill this ideal. That really has no chance, especially if that ideal is something other than feeding its people and being an economic haven and basis and so on. That kind of an ideal is all right, but if it's the ideal of some spiritual idea, it's going to have a very hard time. Now, if people get together and make a community that works, and they're also idealists, well, then they can make a very good community that works. So idealism as such is a good thing. But communities built on an ideal that is not related to the practical existence of life, as we have described it, is bound to fail. Now, what does harmony really mean anyway? Okay, I suppose you could say that people work together without friction. That is not just idealism, that's utopia. There is no place where people work together without friction. It's utopia. Maybe, of course, you think Vaikuntha's like that, that's another thing. But we're talking about the real world. There is always friction. If there was not that kind of friction, there would be no development or growth. Because usually that friction fuels transformation, makes things better, creates evolution. It can also ruin things, but that's, you take the good with the bad. So to have a place where everything is very harmonious in that sense is utopian. Utopias don't exist. It's just an idea. Now, harmony. Let's talk about harmony in a very, shall we call it, generic sense for a community. A generic type of harmony might be a community where it functions, where it works. People have enough money. They have a way to make money. They can therefore, with their money, buy food, buy things they need. They feel comfortable there. And in their personal lives comfort, they can relate with others in the community, their neighbors or whatever, in a kind of more secure fashion, where they're not demanding things from others or demanding respect. Or that's harmonious enough. That's the kind of harmony one should aim for. One should aim for that kind of harmony. Because no other form of harmony is actually harmonious. When you think about harmony, harmony is based on, let's say you hit a certain kind of a tone on the instrument, and tones which are related to that tone are called harmonies. And so if you have an idea of harmony that's not related to any tone of this planet, it's not really harmony. So if you have, let's say, the economic tone, and then you create other forms of relationship or structure in your society which are harmonious to it, then you've got real harmony, because it's something real at the root of that key, of that structure, of that tonality. So that's my statement, that you don't have to worry about people being harmonious with each other in any other kind of idealistic sense. They just have to be able to work with each other. I mean, sometimes you can even do business with a person you're not terribly harmonious with, but if the business works, you're all right with that. Because you have a common task. If you demand the other person be like you, or if you demand that they have a kind of harmonious action or relation with you, that demand or expectation will force disharmony to erupt, or in other words, force conflict to erupt. Therefore, it's even better to find some basis upon which you can work together with others and not demand a bigger basis or a broader basis, to just find some basis and grow from there. Now, there's another question about cities. What is the future of cities? Let's look, for example, at Moscow. Most people bought places in Moscow when the prices for places were extremely cheap. First of all, nobody owned anything. They were all rentals. And then when they had the opportunity to buy, they paid very little. Now the prices are so high that only rich people can buy good places. Everybody else is living in the place they had gotten when prices were low. Now just let that expand. The price of cars, the price of gas, the price of food, the price of existence. It's growing rapidly. That means living in the city is becoming more and more expensive. Yet people who live outside the city, the growth of their prices is very much less. As you move further away from the city, the cost of living and so on is much less. So that means the main factor of city dwellers will be the cost of living, the cost of energy, the cost of facility, the cost of even moving to a different place. So those who have jobs that pay a lot, those who have capacities that they can work, those who have money can live in the cities. I see that model as continuing. I don't see the collapse of cities. I see the evolution of cities as places of wealth. Of course, there may be some parts of cities which are slummy parts, bad parts, not good parts, where the poorer people live. But if you look in New York City, you will see that even a place like Brooklyn, of course, you don't know what Brooklyn is, but it was pretty much a dump, this whole part of New York City. And things were rather inexpensive in Brooklyn. Everything cost money in Manhattan. Yes, it was not. But as Manhattan developed and grew, people started to develop Brooklyn. And they were making it nicer and nicer, section by section. And that is pushing all the way across Brooklyn. And now things everywhere have developed much better, and it's become a much higher class place to live. So one sees the phenomena that even these lower class places, ultimately in the future, as less higher class places are available to the rich, they will become developed. So either you have the possibility of a slum developing where people can't pay to maintain it. You know what a slum is? A slum is like a real bad place, everything broken down, poor people everywhere. It's not a high-class place. So either you will have, for example, a very slummy kind of a place, or you will have that place ripped down by rich people who will build up nice places. But cities will go on, because there's a reason for them to be there. It allows easy employment, easy work, easy way to move from work. But for those who have difficulty with it, meaning those who can't economically make it in the city, and I can't say how many people that's going to be, they're going to have to find alternative ways to live. And this is not an option, this is going to be a necessity. As prices increase beyond the range and capacity of people to pay, they will be forced to find alternative places to live. And thus, these community kind of arrangements will develop because there's no other choice. And where it's successful, it'll grow. Now, I've got another question, and I think this is a very important question, because this question really strikes at a conditioning we have been exposed to with this idea of community in the past. And that conditioning is based around a community should have a philosophical basis. Philosophical concepts should rule the development of community. But you do not find any example of this anywhere in the world or even anywhere in history where you may find an attempt to do it. You will find thousands of attempts to create real community. Thousands of them have been started. You will not find one that has lasted even over one or two generations or three generations. Because the forces of the philosophical concepts rip at the very fiber of the community. The forces of these concepts, the power of them, the demands of these concepts, rip at the fiber of that which makes community function, that which makes community work. When these, especially these concepts, insist that you must be a certain way, or they start demanding things from you, then we get into all kinds of issues, and they're all based on economy. That if I have a philosophical concept ruling me, and that philosophical concept includes what I do with my money, how much of it I have to give somebody, what I can and can't do in my family life, what I can and cannot do at home, you will find this concept will rip into the core the stability of community. There, it's not a mistake, it's not an accident that the real basis of society is a homogeneous weaving of the most essential parts of society in one unit, as you find in Varnashram. And even if you look in Varnashram, you'll see you've got the military, the government, the management, the money, the capitalism. You've got people working, the arts, the individuals. And you've got that kind of, I'm not going to say spirituality as the overriding concept, not at all. I'm going to say morality, because the so-called Brahminical ideal has a lot to do with goodness, with morality, with ethics, with making sure that people don't go bad, that rulers don't go wrong, that people don't start exploiting each other, that principles like honesty and fairness and mercy and sharing and care don't get lost. So the ideal of the society is that people have to be good, evolving, and that things have to work within that holistic package of spirituality. And what is that spirituality? I, the living being, am involved in a existence-long attempt to evolve. As long as I have existed, I am in this attempt to evolve. And at the same time, I have to live in this world, and things have to work. That's the package deal. That's the foundation of society. So economics is the foundation upon which the functioning of a society works, but all elements have to be there for it to really work. So I wouldn't say the root of community is economy. I wouldn't say it's philosophical concepts. I would say the root is this holistic convergence of all of these elements, these four major elements, into a sustainable, attractive package. I mean, when we talk about root, well, root is a tough word to deal with here. Foundation and root are not the same. Foundation is like what you put a house on. It's that upon which everything stands. You do not live in the foundation. You live on it. You don't live in your money. You live off of it. But philosophy is the same. You don't live off of your philosophy. You don't even live on your philosophy. We've seen that where people get together in spiritual communities. As soon as there's a conflict, there's incredible fighting, power struggles, political struggles, even murder, because that's the passion of people. So, philosophical concepts, they all believe the same thing, yet they could kill each other over it even. They can even kill each other over a philosophical discussion. This is not a foundation. And neither is it the root. Because these people who want to get together and make society obviously are not very advanced in their spirituality. They are people who are attempting in their spirituality. Now somebody might say, okay, we have our ideals though, our ideals. Again, ideals are tough things to live by when your ideals are tested by reality. You may be nonviolent and you may never want to kill, but as soon as you get in your car at night and your lights are on and you drive, you are slaughtering insects by the hundreds. If you even drink milk, if you even buy cheese or butter, in this ideal, you are supporting the slaughter of cows. Because if everybody stopped the dairy, everybody stopped eating the meat, there'd be no need to kill cows. So the vegetarians who say, well, I'll take all the products of the cow that the farmers are glad to sell to you, because when the cow doesn't make milk anymore, they just kill it. This is the whole basis of the vegan movement. The vegan movement it's based on the concept that you are equally responsible for the death of the cows by supporting the ecosystem, and it's an ecosystem which says that I will have these cows and make tons of them because I make money in two ways, by selling the milk and then selling the meat. When the cow no longer gives milk, or even after 3 or 4 years or 2 years, just think about that. If the farmers couldn't sell the milk and the cheese, they wouldn't be able to afford even to kill the cows. So philosophically, your concept says no killing of cows. But you are taking these products from the cows. You are supporting the ecosystem to kill cows. Now, I'm not saying you should do this. It's not like I'm trying to convince you. It's not my responsibility. I don't even care on one level if you eat meat or not. If you drink alcohol or take drugs or smoke or do whatever you do. That's not my concern. I'm not the police department. I love animals. I don't like if they're killed. But you know, it happens. Plenty of people eat meat. Lord Ramachandra ate meat. It's not like we can start judging these people on the basis of a philosophical principle. We can try to arrange things so it doesn't happen, but personally. But if you go around and you say to people, you're bad because you do this, yet at the same time, you're supporting the same industry, maybe in a good way by drinking milk and feeling very pleased with yourself, you're just as responsible for the system. Think about that. I may not say, okay, you know, I don't think it's you should stop drinking, for instance. But I would inform you that, you know, there's a lot of research out there that these things can cause liver cirrhosis, can harm your health. What to speak of smoking cigarettes absolutely gives you cancer. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, there are reasons for your sake not to do something. But when it comes to dairy products, it's not necessarily your sake. Of course, we don't have to start speaking about all the hormones and antibiotics and pesticides and herbicides these cows are eating, which goes into their milk, which goes into you, and creates enormous difficulty in your hormonal structure and metabolism. We don't have to speak about that. But what's interesting is that somebody can think they're following a regulative principle, and that's very good because they are saving the animals, yet at the same time they're participating in a system which directly causes the destruction of animals. And yet at the same time they would criticize somebody who drinks beer or even coffee or tea. Green tea is fabulous for you. It's got caffeine in it, no doubt. But it's a fabulous thing for your health. Anyway, I'm not here to say what you should do or what you shouldn't do. But what I am saying is that when you base a community on quote-unquote philosophical principles, you run the risk of enormous hypocrisy. You run the risk of destruction of people's lives. And you absolutely not only run a risk, you will absolutely sign the death warrant of that community at some point in the future. So, hey, I'm interested in the community working. I couldn't care less if the community had principles and it worked over long periods of time. I'm a pragmatist. I have no problem with philosophical principles. I live by philosophical principles, but they're mine. But if a philosophical principle is the cause of difficulty in creation of community, I just set it aside. Or if it harms people, I set it aside. But we're talking about community here. So therefore, I don't feel that these philosophical principles or concepts, well, of course, philosophical principles was the wrong term because there are principles, philosophical principles you use in the development of a society. When you talk about the philosophy of society, the social philosophy, the social communal philosophy, these are really philosophical principles that you should talk about. But if you're talking about the kind of concepts which I think the questioner was referring to, no, I don't agree with that. These kind of spiritual, religious concepts, no, I don't believe in that. As the foundation of a society, as the foundation of a community. But philosophical principles as a foundation of society in general, sure, I've been talking about them the whole lecture. Obviously, I believe in them. Yeah, a question arose which said that what's wrong with living independently? What's wrong with living anywhere? Because, after all, what's wrong with that? Hey, there's nothing wrong with that. I was just bringing up a trend. If you remember what I talked about in this lecture, I started talking about these astrological trends. And I started talking about scientific, economic, political trends, which led me to agree with somebody's idea that community, little echo centers, little economic centers of community are going to be that which is the only viable format for anybody but the richest kind of people. And that's why I'm talking about it. It's not that I'm telling you should not live in your flat in Moscow. That's absurd. But what I'm saying is that when it gets to the point where living in your flat in Moscow becomes too expensive, life in Moscow becomes too much stress, making ends meet becomes impossible, and you are forced to change. Remember, another concept we talked about here was, you will not change until you are forced to change. And what will force you? Money. Stress about money. Being able to live or not. When you get to that point, remember this lecture. You will understand it a lot better. I have a very interesting question from Harshi, I must say. It's not even a question, it's a comment. And I really like it because it's a very important thing. After all, Prabhupada was a very influential person obviously in a lot of people's lives, especially a lot of people who are listening to this lecture. If not directly, then indirectly. And many people have fallen into this idealistic idea about him. This extremely idealistic idea. And this idealism was filtering through all aspects of the way things were developing. And even as early as the very end of 1970s, I realized that, see, he had always been talking about Varnashram. And every time he did it, because at least half of his lectures had a big chunk of it about Varnashram. And every time I heard this, I started to think involuntarily, oh no, not this junk about Brahmanas and Kshatriyas and Vaishyas. I've heard this stuff a million times. I know what the Brahmanas should do. I know what the Kshatriyas should do. I know what the Vaishyas should do. It's easy stuff. You hear it once, you know it forever. I don't want to hear it. It has no relation to me. I'm not going to go into a Varnashram society. Nobody's going to make a Varnashram society. I actually thought that. So then by the end of the 70s, I never said it, but by the end of the 70s, I started thinking, look at this mess all around me. And it's all based on money. It's all based on economy. All this mess is based on money. People wanted to speak about zonal acharyas and all that nonsense. And they did not know it from a zonal acharya's point of view that ultimately it boiled down to money. If you allowed some other guru to come into your zone, they would steal away your disciples and you would lose the people who made money. End of story. People were thinking in modern terminology the way they think now, you know. But in those days it was the Wild West. You would have a big guru who had charisma ride in on his white horse, shooting his guns in the air, yelling Yahoo and lassoing with his rope. And usually it was young women, especially if the guru was very attractive. Honestly, this is the way it worked. They were going, oh, Guru Dave! And what would happen? They would leave your temples and go to the white horse guru's temples. So you would lose money because they couldn't collect. So if you wanted to keep up with the other guy, you had to get on your silver horse and have bigger guns and have a bigger lasso and shinier boots with very attractive spurs. and know how to ride your horse better. And ride into his zone and pull out money makers. And at the bottom line, that's what it was all about. It had very little to do with acharya. It had everything to do with money. That's the way I saw it anyway. So I felt only way I'm going to survive in this environment is to put some nice walls up around my ranch to keep my cattle in my ranch so economically we can survive. Because I don't like horses. I don't like riding off into other people's zones to bring in more cattle and brand them, which the HKS brand didn't work for me. So I thought walls were very good. Fences around my ranch were very good. And it was all because we were living in the Wild West. No law. Okay, gradually we tried to figure out how to make law, but law was only as valuable as the people who agreed to follow it. Anyway, think about this. This varnashram that I couldn't stand. So I realized I'm living in social chaos. I'm living in a world which is really nuts. And we have to do something to stabilize it. So I thought, we need social structure. You can pass resolutions, you can pass laws, you can tell people, don't do this, don't do that. But you need a structure. And then I thought, that's what Prabhupada's talking about. He's not talking about varnashram. He's talking about social structure. But he's speaking about the principles within which social structure work. Now, Prabhupada was not a sociologist. He did not know the vocabulary of social engineering. But he knew social engineering very well. He was an economist by training in the university. And he knew the principles of economics very well. He had also practiced it in his life as a businessman, a successful businessman. And he also had a product which was very close to his heart, which was very close to his ideals, his books. And it gave him a reason for existence. Create these books. You go out and sell them. I'm happy. We make money. It's a real clean business, and we support ourselves this way. It's economic. After a while, he saw, well, not everybody can do this, and making books, selling books only makes enough money maybe for a temple, and some people, like those who live in Los Angeles, need to make more money, so let them make incense business. And he was continuously managing temples and worrying about money. Seeing him manage in Vrindavan was a real eye-opener. He went through every single penny that was being spent, in India it was a paisa, to make sure that every single expenditure was proper. Checking the books himself. Authorizing or denying an expense himself. Because in his mind, the less you spend, the more you have to spend. So he was totally into economics. I would say his weakness was in the unification of economics within a social environment. Especially the weakness was in a familial environment. There may be many reasons for that. I don't really care anymore. But there were very important points to be learned, even in that whole experience, that even he understood that fundamental basis of society. And it's essential for any society to see it as a whole package. And that whole package does not have to be in the context of Krishna consciousness or Christianity or the Mormon religion or the Islamic religion or any religion. It has to be in the context of people, in the context of what we are as spirit. And that's the context that's important. And maybe somebody is a Mormon, somebody is a Muslim, somebody is a Hare Krishna, somebody is another kind of Gaudiya, somebody's a Madhvacharya follower, somebody's a Mayavadi, somebody's a Buddhist. They can live together even with spiritual principles based upon that morality, that mode of goodness, when they have an economic reason to relate, when they have a social reason to relate, or even if they just live next to each other, maintaining peace for the sake of their neighborhood. So I think it's important that we even take that experience and we place it within the context of what makes things work. Because it'll be a very fascinating discussion for all, especially societies that still haven't dealt with the needs of them as people. Anyway, his comment made me speak about it in that way. I think it's important that we stop depersonalizing Prabhupada or other personalities. Stop depersonalizing these prophets. Stop pushing them beyond the realm of human beingness. Stop pushing them outside of our capacity to be like human beings. That we have to emulate these inhuman or non-human people. Because it doesn't work. We are people. We are human. And when we accept it and live with it, in whatever spiritual context we feel best, there's a possibility of developing a harmonious structure within which we can cooperate. Anyway, maybe I blabbed too much. You know, it's funny here. I got a question about a mother is asking about the child and the need of milk. And in actual, the way in which, shall we say, the usual nursing of children went on, is that when they do need the milk, the mother's breast milk is there. That's the actual milk the child needs most. I don't really know, medically speaking, if the child doesn't get breast milk, sure, you have to give the child some other milk. Naturally, children need that. But the mother's breast milk is made for the child. The cow's milk is made for the calf. Therefore, in traditional cultures, the mother's milk was reserved for the child for many years until the child felt to take something else. And those kids were really strong and much less filled with immune deficiencies or allergies or other things. And I think that this modernization of children's milk has, in one sense, harmed children to a certain extent. Especially if you think of all the junk they put in milk. Of course, they don't go and inject junk in milk, but they put in the cow, which puts it in the milk. And that stuff goes into these very tender children's bodies. There's even examples, I mean, it may sound a little weird, where 9-year-old girls are developing breasts unnaturally because of the growth hormones that go into cows. You've got, because of these hormones that go into cows, young girls are developing in a very strange way, totally unnaturally. 8 years old. This is medical fact. This is not my creation here to be shocking. This is medical fact that the development of people has changed because of what they put in milk. So if you're thinking, idealistically, giving my child milk is the best thing for my child, well, you may be doing the worst thing for your child, especially if you have some philosophical reason for doing it. The best thing for the child is the mother's milk. But anyway, I'm not saying you shouldn't do anything. You know, I'm just talking from a medical point of view, not a philosophical point of view. I'm just talking straight from your health. Okay, well, we're out of questions, and I don't feel very meditative today. I feel very battle-y. You know, you might have noticed I'm ready to do battle, ready to fight the fight, ready to spar with the social scientists who are screwing up things, or ready to embrace those who really want to make a transformation in the world. That's how I feel today. I'm being asked by Kamala Mala. He's a very practical person. He wants to know, what do we do? What kind of a business should we develop? Should we have land? If we have land, should we develop some ecologically pure food or water? What do I suggest? Hey, listen, I am not an entrepreneur. I am not somebody who can figure out businesses. Okay, I can figure out how you can run a business once you've got it, but I couldn't figure out what's the best product and what's the best thing to do it or how you should do it and so on. But I know one thing when it comes to food, that as people's awareness develops, as people change, they will realize about how their bodies and their minds and therefore their health is being affected by what they eat. Now, in Russia, this understanding is very primitive. It's in its infantile stage. But in America, it was not very advanced 30 years ago. Even 20 years ago, people didn't think about it. Then gradually and then more rapidly, all of a sudden, it became a huge business. And those people who had been organically growing not only food, but their business started to become very powerful and very wealthy. And they all started from some small attempt. And so when I think about Russia, I think, what a place to start off with, like, offering health food alternatives, offering ecological food, offering ecologically created products, offering water filter systems, offering energy systems, offering health products, medical products, in a very systematic fashion, offering books about this, offering DVDs, videos, getting on the radio, broadcasting. It's like prime. It's like being at ground zero. If you grow from this point now and do something significant, you can't imagine how rich you're going to be in the future. Just my suggestion. I've been suggesting it for the last 9 years there in Russia. I said, go for health, go for healing, go for pure food, go for ecology. Because I saw that's what everything was moving towards. The more polluted everything gets, the more people want pure things. It's like the whole basis. So did it help or not? Ah, it helped. Okay, there you go. I did something good today. You know what's funny about ISKCON history? I really laugh at the way it's being rewritten nowadays. I laugh at what people say. It's like, you know, when they got rid of Stalin in Russia, it's like, you know, you just rewrite things and you just create new understandings. It's history is like that. It just means whoever's got the power to do so changes everything. And you can see history in so many different ways, especially if you were there and you had some way, other way to see it. And if you see it from different directions, you'll be able to understand what to do better today. So lucky for you who are listening, you've got the unique experience of somebody who was there. Of course, others will say, no, 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 not so, And of course, they'll be right from their own point of view. And they'll have people who agree with them. That's just the way it is.